Coming up on Fronteras, more miners from south of the border are making the dangerous journey to the U.S. illegally and all alone.
We're just seeing unprecedented numbers of children coming across without any kind of parents coming across or guardians coming across with them.
Some miners are being housed at Joint Base San Antonio-Lackland. We take a look at exactly where they're staying. Also on the show, a look at Alzheimer's disease in the Mexican-American community.
Do they get withdrawn from their activities? If they've always liked to golf or play bingo and all of a sudden they don't want to do that because they don't like it, it's maybe that they don't understand the concept of the game anymore. So that's when you start to see that something is amiss.
Alzheimer's and dementia among one of the fastest growing groups in America. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. Sheriffs recently testified at the Texas State Capitol that DPS officers in border counties are too often overly aggressive against citizens pulled over for routine traffic stops. But the allegations are hardly confined to state troopers. So, if you are stopped, what questions must you answer? Following recent allegations of harassment along the Texas border, Marfa Public Radio's Lorne Madelon looked into what questions law enforcement, state or federal, can ask you.
The answer, except in Arizona, where police can ask you about immigration status, is theoretically simple. If you're the driver, you must show registration, insurance, and a driver's license. If you're just a passenger and you're not being arrested, you don't. Here's Texas DPS Captain Luis Najera.
As far as the questions that the trooper is permitted to, there are really no restrictions.
What is a citizen compelled to answer?
Legally, they would be compelled to identify themselves and present their driver's license. Any conversation beyond that is really not something that they're compelled to do.
And that's all he says. Najera runs DPS in five border counties from far west Texas to the New Mexico border. DPS hasn't responded to damning testimony from sheriffs at the Texas State Capitol in Austin. Like Sheriff Eusebio Salinas, they said state police tactics are fraying nerves among citizens.
It disrupts the community. It creates mayhem.
In January, an artist from Marfa, Texas, Camp Bosworth, was a passenger in a car driven by his wife.
I said, I don't have to give you my ID. I'm not, you know, I've done nothing wrong, and I'm a passenger in this vehicle.
Bosworth and his wife, Buck Johnston, were returning from a hospital where Bosworth was treated for an eye injury. Both say they were asked questions that offended them.
Like, are you married? Why don't you share the same name? And then she looked at my husband and she said, you look familiar. Why do you look familiar? Are you hiding something? And he was like, no, I'm not hiding anything. I'm injured and I'm wanting to go home.
You know, it's my constitutional right not to be questioned and not to be ID'd without probable cause. It was my duty to say, you know, hey, my constitutional rights are being violated here. Am I under investigation? No. Have I done anything wrong? No.
The trooper said they'd been driving in a passing lane. She let them go. But to focus on state troopers exclusively isn't fair. Sheriffs and police sometimes use the same approach. Karen Crenshaw, a 51-year-old who just moved to West Texas, says she was stopped for not coming to a complete stop at the sole traffic light in rural Marfa, Texas.
You know, I've always had a great respect for law enforcement, and I've never felt nervous or upset when they pulled me over.
She says it was around 11 at night in late April, and the two deputies gave her a written warning after questioning she believes wasn't relevant.
Where did you move here from? And do you have any illegal substances in the car? Have you ever been arrested or convicted of a felony? It just felt like overkill.
Constitutional law professor Meg Penrose at Texas A&M Law School says that kind of questioning, beyond the scope of the traffic offense, is itself a violation.
And the longer an officer holds you beyond a traffic stop, when there is no probable cause to continue to detain you, that officer has actually then committed an unconstitutional seizure.
She says that's not the case at Border Patrol checkpoints. Agents can ask you questions you don't have to answer. But if an agent suspects you're in the U.S. illegally, you can be legally detained. Things are different in Arizona. The Department of Justice has just told the state it won't challenge Arizona's so-called show-me-your-papers provision, Although that provision is under challenge from a class action lawsuit, that means that for now, officers can still stop you and ask you to show you're in the country legally. I'm Lorne Madelon in Marfa, Texas.
We continue our coverage of so-called unaccompanied alien children now. 80,000 children since last October have made their way to the U.S. to escape violence in Central America. Texas Public Radio's Eileen Pace joined a media tour overseen by the military Thursday of the Air Force Barracks at Joint Base San Antonio Lackland, where 1,200 immigrant children who came to the U.S. without adults are being temporarily sheltered in San Antonio.
Situated in the midst of dozens of identical military barracks where young men and women go through Air Force basic training every day, this one building is now filled with children, more than 1,000 of them. It's a three-story beige dorm building that would normally be drab in its decor, but now paper flower decals decorate the windows and papel picado, or brightly colored perforated paper, hangs as curtains over the windows in the girls' dorm.
The problem is huge.
Chris Cabrera is on the front lines of the U.S. Border Patrol. At his office in McAllen, Texas, Cabrera says his officers are apprehending 500 to 700 kids every day. More on the weekends. Within 72 hours, those children must be turned over to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services for care. And that's how many of these kids have ended up at Lackland. Media on the tour were not permitted to use tape recorders or to interact with the kids, but most of the children made eye contact and many smiled back. We saw dozens of older boys, perhaps 14 to 18 years old, in an outdoor classroom listening to a man speak to them in Spanish. An adjacent area provided sofas and chairs where other boys relaxed together in the shade. Inside were intake rooms where children as young as 12 were interviewed. A weary-looking child leaned his head on the shoulder of an older boy. Air Force posters still hang on cafeteria walls, but the showers are now modified so each child has privacy. There's a supply room filled with boxes of new clothing and shelves of toys like Jenga and bubbles, frisbees, and balloons. Each child has a clean bed with a mattress, not a cot, and lockers for personal things. A group of girls studied English in a classroom that was oddly decorated both with the children's drawings of home, such as their country's flags or musical instruments, alongside leftover Air Force posters showing aircraft or various phases of basic training. Lackland has seen almost 2,000 kids come through since it opened the barracks to the children on May 18th. Almost 1,000 have already been processed out to vetted families or sponsors. In a phone conference earlier this week, White House Director of Domestic Policy Cecilia Munoz said the administration has elevated the situation to a humanitarian emergency and the refugee resettlement program has become involved.
This is an increase over what we've seen in previous years. It also includes more girls and more children under the age of 13 compared with previous years.
The White House said another group of about 500 children were being transferred to a naval base in California. In San Antonio, kids as young as 12 will continue to be processed through Lackland and younger children through other nonprofit humanitarian organizations, while federal agencies work together to figure out some solution to the growing problem of kids escaping Central America for what they hope will be a better life in the U.S. For Fronteras, I'm Eileen Pace.
And coming up, a look at Alzheimer's disease in the Mexican-American community.
Do they get withdrawn from their activities? If they've always liked to golf or play bingo, and all of a sudden they don't want to do that because they don't like it.
Fronteras continues after the break. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. As demographics change across the nation and in Texas, there's growing concern about Alzheimer's disease among Mexican Americans, a population that continues to age. More than 5 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease today. But by 2050, the nonprofit Alzheimer's Association says up to 16 million people will have the disease. The prevalence for Alzheimer's increases with age, and there's no cure for it right now.
As the population of the United States both ages and turns more Hispanic, then the number of cases of Mexican-American Alzheimer's patients is likely to grow.
That's Dr. Donald Royal of the UT Health Science Center. Alzheimer's is the most common cause of dementia, a syndrome that affects mental capacity to the point of interfering with daily life. Dr. Royal says the prevalence of dementia is higher in Mexican Americans, but he says dementia in Mexican Americans may be caused by factors other than Alzheimer's.
There's a lot of reason to suspect that Mexican Americans may be experiencing a lot of other causes of dementia, like vascular dementia, diabetes can affect cognition, depression can affect cognition, and the rates of all of those problems are higher in Mexican Americans.
Royal says researchers are trying to find ways to diagnose dementia very early on. That way, interventions such as lifestyle changes or medications could be taken to delay the onset and help with the symptoms. But he says factors such as language, culture, and education can make diagnosing dementia more difficult when it comes to minority patients. And here to talk more about this topic, Maxine Vieira, program specialist with the San Antonio and South Texas chapter of the Alzheimer's Association.
We're talking about a very progressive disease that starts and affects the short-term memory first. So whatever you might have learned this morning or this afternoon is what is forgotten often or before. But yet the long-term memory continues to be, and that's when you see all this, the repetitive stories of things that might have happened before or conversations of things they might have done when they were younger. And that's how it affects the brain. It eventually becomes fatal because it does, the way that it progresses, it almost has the body forget how to breathe on its own, how to eat, and so forth. So it's a progressive, in reverse kind of disease.
What are some of the signs that someone has Alzheimer's?
One of the best examples that we use, for example, we all forget where we place our keys. We walk in the house, we place our keys on the table by the door.
That's me.
That's us, all of us, right? Or the glasses, for example. You have them on the top of your head, you left them on the side, you know, table, whatnot. So what happens is that you give up the search because you're frustrated, give up the search, you go do something else, and then the memory strikes you like, oh, I know where I left them, and you go back. The person that starts to have serious problems with memory or the dementia, they lose the ability to retrace those steps back. Because you and I can go, okay, I walked in the door, I placed them by the side door, or I went to this and this, and you go through all your steps. The person that has memory problems is not able to do that anymore. And so you start to see them, you know, be more confused than before, more forgetful. Maybe they're skipping a payment. They're going on shopping sprees because the filters for, you know, judgment get compromised. Maybe they're cursing more than before. Do they get withdrawn from their activities? If they've always liked to golf or play bingo and all of a sudden they don't want to do that because they don't like it, it's maybe that they don't understand the concept of the game anymore. So that's when you start to see that something is amiss. And they become more forgetful. Is it interfering with their daily life? And you want to pay attention to those signs.
There's you hear a lot about those little brain games, and you can do them on your phone, and there's apps to keep yourself sharp. I mean, is that really something the experts recommend people do to keep their mind sharp?
The way we tell individuals is if a special diet for you works, keeps you healthy throughout, if a special way of exercise, you know, keeps you and maintains you, you know, even if brain games can help you and maintain, by all means, you should exercise and eat well and do all of that for your own benefit. Again, once a person is on track to developing Alzheimer's, once the doctors identify the biomarkers that somebody will develop Alzheimer's disease, then there's nothing that can prevent you from that. But it can maintain you for a while. I mean, that's why there's medication to maintain someone and amplify their brain, but, you know, their memory, but not necessarily keep the disease from fully developing in someone.
If someone is on that track and that you mentioned that is irreversible, what are resources and things that can be done to improve their quality of life for them and their caregivers?
Education is key. The more educated as a family caregiver and even the individual who has the disease, the more qualified we are to handle the disease, the better prepared we are to handle the stress. The Alzheimer's Association, we can provide you with resources on how to tap into that information. You know, are you going to bring someone into the home to help you in their care? Are you looking at placement? When is the time to do the placement? And so we have all of that information available to our families. We conduct regularly different education programs throughout the community so that families can attend, and they're free of charge all the time. We're hosted by different facilities in the area as well as churches and other places. And it's a way of meeting other families that may be going through the same thing as our caregivers. Because oftentimes, you know, as a caregiver, we feel that we're the only ones experiencing such, you know, distress in caring for a loved one. But it's other families that may be going through the same things as well.
You say we. Is there some? Are you a caregiver for someone?
I am. I'm actually a caregiver for a mom who has diabetes type 2 and is already exhibiting dementia problems. So we're thinking we're still at a somewhat good place with her, but we're looking and facing probably, you know, the diagnosis, what it is, that it is a vascular dementia and that she's in decline, and we have to be aware of that. So
how old is your mother, if you don't mind me asking?
No, my mom is 78 years old. So, and but then in her case as well, she's had other health problems that she has to deal with. So all of that compounded has really been the determining factor of where we're at with her today. And so in caring for her, it's also a learning experience for me. And so I can now relate to our caregivers. I'm not just letting them know this is what, you know, what we could do, or this is how we should approach this. But I understand their journey as well.
You're speaking from experience.
Absolutely.
There's a strategy that sounds interesting to educate people about all of this called pláticas or talks. Tell me about that.
Yes, las pláticas, conversations about dementia, is an effort of the Alzheimer's Association to reach out to our Hispanic community, which we know traditionally is the one that least seeks out help. We will continue to care for our loved ones at home, even though we're in distress. And so we want to educate the Hispanic community. There are resources available to them that, in most cases, at no cost to them. And so Las Pláticas came about as that effort. And we partner with Dr. Yvonne Lozano, who is a gerontologist in San Antonio. And she has, you know, helped us throughout many our symposium and education programs. And we're developing something that we can bring to them at, you know, how the Hispanic community may not feel intimidated. So we're working on the details for that, but we're aiming hopefully for early fall to have something available in October.
The Alzheimer's Association's Maxine Vieira says those pláticas or talks would be informal town hall meetings to help Hispanic families who are caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's or who want to plan ahead. Texas ranchers are considering a proposed new marketing program for the state's beef industry. Most of the industry's big players back the measure, and it seems likely to pass. Ranchers have already been paying into national marketing efforts for years, and with this new program, they'd pay another dollar per head of cattle into a fund promoting Texas beef. But as Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik reports, some say these checkoff programs, as they're known, don't do enough to help smaller producers.
Remember these ads?
Beef. It's what's for dinner.
Well, if the Texas beef checkoff passes the vote, we might start hearing similar ads with a specifically Texan twist. Those classic ads from the early 90s were funded by the National Beef Checkoff, a mandatory program set up as part of the Reagan-approved Farm Bill from 1985. Half of the dollar per animal ranchers already pay in goes to marketing beef on the national scene. Half goes back to promoting burgers and brisket at the state level. All the money brought in with this new program would stay in Texas. The idea has been to reverse the trend of America's declining demand for beef, and rancher Bobby McKnight says it's definitely helped.
Through that dollar, through the years, they've created so many new retail products and probably added $200, $250 of value to each animal.
McKnight's the director of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, one of the industry's largest voices. Driving around Fort Davis, where he spent most of his life, he tells me the potential benefits from a Texas checkoff are limitless. I ask him if the extra dollar per head ranchers will have to pay adds up to a lot.
No, it is, in my mind, insignificant, and the value we get from such a modest investment I don't know how you could not support that.
But some ranchers don't think it's a good idea.
There's no reason to think that telling people to go buy beef has any effect on the prices of somebody who is direct marketing their beef at a farmer's market. It's a completely different marketing system.
Judith McGeary is a rancher in Central Texas and head of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. The group represents a part of the state's ag community that sees these producer-funded programs as an unnecessary tax rather than an investment. McGeary admits a dollar a head's not a lot of money, but she says smaller ranchers are always struggling to cut costs, and if the market tanked, those dollars could add up. Opponents say generic marketing of beef, or pork or dairy for that matter, helps some more than others, And it's true that when it comes to beef, national checkoff-funded messages have called into question whether buying grass-fed is really worth the price.
And what we've got is producers paying into checkoff after checkoff, which do nothing really but compete with each other, and which never have promoted, you know, farmers market sales, direct sales, grass-fed beef sales, any of the niche markets or specialty markets that many of our members are part of and rely on for their income.
Most of the people that I have encountered that consider this to be a tax don't really understand how the program works in the first place.
That's Stacy Schoenfeld. She's the president of the West of the Pecos chapter of Texas Cattlewomen, another industry group backing the state checkoff. She says anyone in the industry can make their voice heard and push for the kind of ads they want to see. And she argues that even if they don't, the ads can't do anything but help.
At the end of the day, the marketing message that's out there actually benefits every producer, no matter what kind of production style they subscribe to.
This debate actually went to the Supreme Court back in 2005. Cattle ranchers like McGeary argued that forcing people to help pay for ads they don't agree with violated their right to free speech. But the court ruled against that argument, saying federally mandated marketing is actually government speech, which isn't subject to the First Amendment. Checkoff opponents say there's a simple solution. Make it voluntary. Schoenfeld says that's a good idea in theory.
But I think once you get into that, you have too many people who sit back and say, what's being done now is good enough, and I'm just going to kind of ride the wave, so to speak.
Whether the industry needs the checkoff is an open debate. The market's certainly not hurting right now. Beef prices just reached record highs this year. And even though herd sizes have been dropping because of the drought, the USDA predicts Americans will gradually start eating and producing more beef over the next decade. But the National Beef Campaign has had to make cuts because of a basic economic reality. The dollar of today is worth about half what it was worth in the mid-80s, and the industry groups pushing the new state program say it's needed simply to offset those losses and keep the industry growing. Reporting in West Texas for Marfa Public Radio, I'm Travis Bubinick.
That's it for Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. You can find the entire audio for this program and past shows online at tpr.org. Just look under the Programs tab. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks so much for listening.